Good evening, folks. This is The Weird Part, and I am your host, Vincent Treewell. Tonight, I am pleased to welcome a very special guest, Joshua Cutchins. This should be a really excellent episode of this particular podcast. Josh, do you want to say hello to our listeners?
Hello to our listeners.
All right. Obviously, Joshua Cutchins probably needs little to no introduction to people who would listen to The Weird Part. He's the author of several books, a true paranormal researcher and investigator, and probably as well as a professional musician, I should add that, and probably the leading intellectual pioneer when it comes to the topic of the fey folk fairy phenomenon. But it deals with a lot of other things too. Let's just kind of jump right into it.
Well, I'm flattered. I'm going to push back on that about the leading scholar on the fey folk, because there are people who can talk circles around me when it comes to the nitty-gritty of things. I will say that I'm not aware of anybody who has focused on sort of situating most of the supernatural in that sort of fairy folk lens. So maybe you can get away with saying that.
And I guess I'm speaking from my own, you know, perspective, my own knowledge. Until I heard you on Soraya's podcast and on Timothy Brenner's podcast, I didn't know anybody was taking that particular topic seriously and looking into it. I read 14 Times, a British magazine, and they'll mention fae topics once in a while, but not in a very in-depth manner at all. And so I only was aware that it was a thing because of your work.
It is the gift that keeps on giving. especially when you like look at the you know, the alien abduction phenomena, which, you know, you can sort of separate if you want to from UFOs a little bit. I think that those are sometimes over conflated. Not that they shouldn't be related, but sometimes I think they're over conflated. But yeah, there was a time when I used to say that, you know, well, maybe the fae phenomena and the alien abduction phenomena are, you know, they're sort of using the same mechanisms, or maybe they're, and you know, I've just come around to the point where I think that, you know, it really is one and the same thing. Now, you know, the jury's out as to exactly what that means. I think that the fairy interpretation is probably incorrect, and that the alien interpretation is probably more incorrect, and that the fairy interpretation is probably closer to whatever the objective truth is. But I still think that it's kind of a slippery thing to try to pin down. But I'm at the point now where I can, you know, if you give me enough time, I can find some sort of correlation between, you know, the alien abduction stuff and the fairy folklore as well. You know, it just after I saw that there was an analog for like alien implants in fairy folklore, I was like, okay, I'm done. You know, this is way too close for comfort. I'm pretty sure that I can find something that, if you look at it through our modern cultural lens, is a pretty close match for what people talk to, you know, especially in Western Europe, but honestly all throughout the world, because it's something that every culture has, are these legends of little people.
Yes. And that it just, yes, it's all around the world, and we don't have any solid answers what it is, but at least we can say some things that these repeat over time and around the world in ways that there's something there, even if we don't know what the hell it is.
Yeah. And I think that, like, you know, people get really caught up and hung up on, like, you know, was this story true? Is that story true? Was this a hoax? Did this person say this or that or the other? And I really think that, for me at least, it none of that really matters so much as the fact that you see these same things repeating themselves out over time and space. You know, you have you have people, you know, the example I always use is like you have a farmer in Casey, Iowa, who's talking about the same stuff that somebody did in an ancient Mesopotamian text, you know, the odds that he's read that or something, just I don't think they hold up well. So for me, it's that comparativism that really is the bread and butter of Fortean study, I think.
Yes, I think you make a very valid point there that, yes, when you see it over and over, there has to be some commonality. Just to kind of shift gears a little bit, kind of tell us a little bit about yourself. How did you get involved in being interested in all this stuff?
You know, I'm kind of amazed when I talk to people who aren't into this stuff, right? it's always been so interesting to me, and it was never really looked down upon in my household. You know, my parents were of the mindset that as long as I was reading, it didn't really matter what I was reading, right? So, you know, I would check out books on a lot of these different things. I was never really so much into the alien thing, or even really myths and legends or anything. I was always into, you know, cryptids. That was my jam growing up. And you know, looking back on it, you know, I've talked to my dad since then. He was like, oh yeah, I was subscribed to the Bigfoot Field Researchers Organization newsletter at one point. And, you know, so I guess my dad had a bit of an interest in that as well. But, you know, I was always interested in monster movies and creature features. Like, that was always my favorite sort of thing. You know, if it had a good creature or a good creature design, I was there for it, you know. I think that just sort of naturally grew out of that. As far as how I got involved, because it's a big difference, right? Like, if you're actually going to sully your name with this, with this stuff, big difference. Is I was at a miserable desk job working at the University of Georgia, and I was commuting an hour each day, and I was looking for podcasts, and I happened upon Mysterious Universe, which sort of leads you in other directions to other people's podcasts and stuff. And I started listening to that and some other shows, and it really just that commute was basically what rekindled my interest. You know, I would you know, go on a business trip to Tampa or something, and I would have to spend, you know, 10 hours in a university van. So I'd load up my podcast on my iPod, and I'd, you know, just listen to paranormal podcasts all the way down. And it was, I suppose, probably 2014, or maybe late 2013. I got a gift card for Christmas from my sister-in-law, and I put it towards a Bigfoot book, because I said, I'm going to indulge myself. I haven't bought a Bigfoot book in a long time, you know, very much of the Flesh and Blood camp at the time, you know, but I was like, I'm going to indulge myself with a Bigfoot book. And I picked out J. Robert Alley's Raincoast Sasquatch, which is a great little book that I don't think people talk about enough.
I've heard of that one. Yeah.
It's about, coastal Alaskan Bigfoot sightings. And there's a lot of indigenous lore and stuff in there. And I remember reading that, I think I tell this story so many times, I should really refresh my memory on which is which, but I think it's the Tlingit Bigfoot analog, the Bequus. And if I got that wrong, I'm sorry, but I believe it's their Bigfoot analog, where they held a belief that if you encountered a Bequus in the forest and it gave you something to eat, you shouldn't eat it or you'd be trapped with the Bequus forever. Now, I don't know where I picked it up, you know, the fairy food taboo, that if you ate food in fairyland, you'd be trapped there forever. But for some reason, I had it in the back of my head. You know, it was like, if I ever run into a situation where I'm up against the little people, like, you know, that's one thing to remember, right? And so I read that.
Eat or drink anything they give you. Yes.
Never. And I said, that's an interesting correlation. Somebody should write a book on that. And I said, and you know, I sat with that thought for a couple of weeks, and I was like, could it be me? So, you know, for all my complaints about that job at Georgia, you know, the summers for staff were a lot less, less hectic. So I actually ended up writing a good chunk of that book at work that summer.
That's a good job sometimes.
I guess so. But, you know, then once it's time to release it, like, everybody's like, what are you doing? and, you know, so in 2015, A Trojan Feast came out, and that same month I quit my job at UGA, not because I, thought that I would, make a living doing this, which has only sort of started to resemble that. But, you know, I was just sort of miserable at that job. And I, you know, I said, I'm going to try, you know, to get a different job, and I'm just going to leave this situation. So I applied to a bunch of jobs, and I'm pretty sure, you know, I made it through some of the hiring process until a certain point. And I feel like at some point in each of those job application processes, somebody was like, let's Google this guy. Can we Google this guy?
Do you really think that it hurts you professionally?
Oh, I absolutely do. There was one interview where, you know, somebody asked, you know, what my other interests were, and I made an allusion to having written a book, and it came out, and you could sort of see him pull back a little bit. So that's fine. You know, I had already sort of pivoted to doing more teaching music and gigging a lot more. And so I just ended up doing that for several years until my sons were born. And then, like I said, in the last couple of years, it's been something where I've, you know, started looking for some more opportunities. And that's what I'm doing full time right now. Is actually, I let go of teaching because, well, for a bunch of different reasons, but I let go of teaching. So I just play and I just write right now. And I'm not the breadwinner, but I keep the wolf from, I don't keep the wolf from the door. I keep the wolf a little bit farther from the door. Let's put it that way.
No, I understand. Yes. That was a concern. It's no big secret. You won't find Vincent Treewell on my birth certificate. I am an attorney licensed in the state of Wisconsin. And, you know, I had some jobs where I didn't want necessarily my other interests to come up, you know. Mm-hmm. And also my legal name is very common. And Google searches don't help. I just disappear into the void.
Right, right.
But Vincent Treewell, there's only one, because it's not really... Treewell isn't really a last name. It's the term for if you have fir trees and it snows a lot, mm-hmm. the little cave that builds under the fir tree.
Yeah.
That's a Treewell.
Oh, and well, there you go.
I saw this on a nature show and said, perfect. And so that helps with the Google searches. And it puts a little distance sometimes where I might want a little distance. But yeah, we digressed all over the place. Yeah.
No. I mean, I think it bears repeating though. And it speaks to the fact that this is one of the few, I know we could probably digress even further with this, but there's still a stigma attached to this stuff. And, you know, even I find myself, you know, backpedaling when I talk to people. Cause that's the thing, you know, whenever I'm at the gig, everybody's like, what's up with the UFO for the O thing? You know, whenever I'm at the UFO conference, they're like, what's, you play the tuba? What, you know, everybody's always a little bit baffled. But you know, when I'm at the gig and that comes up, I'm like, well, look, I don't really want to get into it right now, but what you think, I think is not what I think. Right. You know?
Oh yes. Yes. And there definitely is stigma. Despite the New York Times saying UFOs are real, I felt that was going to be so much more monumental than it turned out to be, which was almost nothing. You know, at the time, though, when they said it, I'm like, okay, we're about 6 months away from the press conference with the alien. They're going to turn over the bodies and the ships and it's all out there. And I will have been right. And you guys, we'll see that. But that's not what happened, obviously. But yeah, there's still stigma around. It's
bad. I don't want to be too disparaging of the community, because we were just talking earlier about how much we love, you know, these communities. But at the same time, a lot of the dialogue that's out there is just like the most basic entry-level stuff. And I realize that everybody's going to start somewhere, but these topics in general are so complex and interesting if you take them beyond that. You know, if you're not just, you know, dredging up dogman stories for YouTube or something, right? Like if you actually start talking about like the nature of consciousness and the nature of reality and the intersection between the imaginal and the imaginary and all these different things, like that's really interesting stuff to me. You know, but with that, you have to say, you have to come into that with a certain level of agnosticism that I don't think a lot of people are comfortable with nowadays, you know.
That is,
I want to come into this topic and I want to find out that there are little green aliens coming down here in spaceships. And it's like, okay, well, this could be really rewarding if you didn't approach it with that idea out of the gate, you know.
The people who are disappointed that Hellier didn't end up with a goblin cage.
Exactly.
You know?
Yeah,
here he is, you know. Come on.
Exactly.
That was never going to end up that way. And either you can accept that or, you know, maybe you should do something else. You know?
Yeah, 100%. That's the most concise way to put it. Yeah.
You know. Not to shift too hard, but just to ask, you are a trained professional musician. Have you ever encountered anything involving music and the paranormal? Like, I mean, this is a big part of the Fae lore. What can you tell us about that?
Well, personally, I haven't.
You're a well-known non-experiencer. Is that about right?
Well, I mean, you know, I've had a lot of maybe things happen, right? You know what I mean? I've had a lot of maybe things and like maybe two or three unambiguous things where I couldn't, you know, after you hear about it or you see it, after you experience that experience, you know, you can't get the toothpaste back in the tube. But for the most part, you know, you talk to people like our mutual friend Soraya and it's like, you know, oh, it's a Tuesday. Of course you saw, you know, a mysterious bubble form out of nowhere and float across your living room. Like, yeah, of course that happened to you. So like, you know, compared to most people that I know, I would say that I'm relatively psychically dead as a doornail. But I do have things happen from time to time, you know, it's always
and same here. I really extremely rarely in my life has anything occurred that I can point to and say, no, this is something not of the ordinary average day-to-day life. A handful of times, you know?
Yeah. Yeah. And you know, so I would love to have had a Bigfoot step out of the trees and, you know, wave high at me, but you know, the best it's like God looked down and said, okay, well, best I can do is Civil War Ghost. How about that? So that's gonna okay, I'll take Civil War Ghost. And you won't know it at the time, you won't know it until later. I'm like, okay, yeah, so the music thing, I haven't personally experienced. There is something to it though, and I think that it would be a good topic for a book at some point, but some people have kind of mind that territory a little bit. So it's not quite the sort of, when I tend to write stuff, I like to sort of go into relatively virgin territory, so that I, you know, have a broad canvas to paint on. He said mixing metaphors.
No, I get you. I started writing a nonfiction book myself and then realized somebody had written that book already, basically.
So, yeah, that's the worst feeling is when you get halfway through a book and you're like, oh, this person wrote this article on this. Oh crap, did they, you know, did they say everything that I'm gonna say? But yeah, there's something to it, you know, regarding the fairy folklore. It's something that you see time and time and again. Oftentimes is like, you know, one of the primary signifiers that the good people are around you. You know, there are even some, I mean, if I were to write about music and the paranormal, I'd probably be approaching it from this angle, because I do have a, you know, the classical training and I also have a musicology degree. So I might be able to talk about some of the music part of it more, with a little bit more authority than some people, I guess. There are some melodies that supposedly are attributed to the fae folk that we still have today. There are some contention back and forth whether or not Danny Boy was one of those melodies, if memory serves. Wow. So you know, to roll up your sleeves and dig into that from a musicological standpoint and be like, well, this is what's happening harmonically and this is why this works and why it doesn't, you know, to sort of look at it from that angle would be I think might be pretty rewarding. But music in general is something that also happens across these other contact modalities that just doesn't get discussed quite as often. By which I mean, you know, just experiences with intelligences. It's quite common in near-death experiences, almost always described the same way as, you know, the fairy music was. Oh, it was wonderful music that didn't seem to be using an earthly scale, and it was indescribable in its beauty. Like, same thing you hear from the people who hear fairy music, and you hear similar things from people who hear music aboard UFOs, which is not as common, but is relatively common. But again, if you look into the contactee literature, I think it was Adamski, used that same description to describe some Saturnian music that he heard when he went to Saturn, supposedly. And, you know, if you're positioned in that area of like, well, I don't know if this is true or not. Like, if you ask me if I really think Adamski went to Saturn, I'm going to say no. But it's interesting that he would describe it that way. You know, it's interesting that he's not like, yeah, it was, you know, it sounded like the Bee Gees, you know. he described it in this other way, which I think is really interesting. So I think there's some things to pull out of there, to pull out of that. But it's on the table. There are a couple of projects that I plan on getting to at some point. And maybe if I take it easy on myself and, you know, don't try to write a 260,000 word book, then maybe I might have enough to say about it. That's unique and novel and new.
Yes. Yes. I don't think I've told you about this. I have mentioned it, but I had a very strange experience a few months ago where I was going to the grocery store and it was the dead of winter. So it's 11 degrees. Okay. And sitting on a park bench, there's one bench. And I've never seen anybody sit there before or since. Sitting on this bench is this well-dressed man who's not dressed for the elements. Okay. It's 11 degrees.
Yeah. Because when I was in Wisconsin and I would have to dress up for concerts, I had my overcoat on, you know, the big heavy overcoat.
Parka, yeah.
Well, no, not, well, not even. Yeah, I had, you know, I still look nice, you know. I had the uh-huh. the actual overcoat.
Oh, yes, the lawyer's coat. Yes.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. Yeah.
There's one. I know it's wool, and yeah, it's 3/4 length. And yeah.
some of the time, the other time I was in my big green LL Bean winter gear. Yeah.
Yes, but you know, it gets cold as hell.
Yeah.
And it's 11 degrees. I'm going to the grocery store, and there's this guy who's not dressed for the elements, wearing a suit and tie, playing a violin. And I wanted to get his picture just for Instagram, but I figured it's kind of impolite to take a musician's picture without giving them some small amount of money. This is not a spot where like local musicians come to. It's not at all, not in the least. This is a strip mall grocery store, and this guy is sitting there playing the violin. He, as I recall, he's a black man and he's wearing a suit and tie and he's playing the violin. And I said, I'm going to go in the grocery store. I'm going to get $5 back. I'm going to give it to him and ask to take his picture. And then I get close and he's playing Celtic music. He's playing, and I am not a musicologist in the faintest. I don't know enough. I know this. I've been to enough festivals that it's Scotch or it's Irish. And it's violin and there's an electronic component too. And that music was unlike anything I've ever heard. Not just because he was really good, but it had, and it's subjective. I understand. I can't prove any of this, but I felt like drawn to that guy. Like I wanted to go over there, hang out with him. And so I went in the grocery store, I come back and he's gone. Didn't see him come, didn't see him leave. Poof, never saw him again. And I have always thought that that might have been one of the good folk.
Well, you know what I think is interesting about that too, is that the dry winter air and the lower temperature are not great for your string instrument, you know? You know, brass players, you've just got a big hunk of metal. So, and you're putting warm, you're putting warm air through it. So, you know, we sort of soldier on, but for, you know, violin, and you know, that's the thing about that, you know, people in the upper Midwest might not realize, but like, you know, yeah, there's snow on the ground, but it can get pretty dry up there, the air.
Oh, yes.
You know? So the idea that you would subject yourself to that in, you know, Milwaukee in the middle of winter, or not the middle of winter, but, you know, you said a couple of weeks ago, so kind of the tail end of winter.
Oh, no, this and, is a couple and then, months ago. It was like the dead of winter.
Well, and like, you know, the finger dexterity that you need for, I mean, I guess all stringed instruments, but especially, you know, those bowed instrument families. I don't, why would you choose that? You know, because you've got to have your fingers out in the cold too. And it just, it doesn't make a lot of sense. I will say that.
That's it. It just seems so out of context that he's not bundled up. And why on earth would you do this on a park bench in front of a grocery store? You know, I mean, obviously it could have happened just normally, naturally, but I just took a huge paranormal vibe from that.
You know? I mean, yeah, so that's very much in the same spirit of the stuff that I get. You know, like on my honeymoon, long story short, I was being a drunken idiot and like shouting out from the hot tub, you know, Bigfoot cries, and then we get in the
just
car.
Just let me a moment to bask in that image.
yeah. And we get in the car to go the next morning, and there's like a basketball sized rock wedged behind one of my rear tires.
Damn.
And like, you know, I can't say that was anything paranormal. There are a lot of reasons. If I sort of set the scene for you, there's a lot of reasons that I think would make it seem less likely to be a prank, but I can't say it wasn't a prank, you know? So I you know, I really don't know. But yeah, that's very much, it's very much in the same spirit that I get.
Yes.
Of the things that I get.
So many of these things, you can never prove it. It's not, you know, there's no DNA, but it's something.
Well, and that's the lovely thing, and too, I think about a lot of the stuff is that it does have that sort of re-enchanting quality in terms of your worldview, you know, because I think a lot of people have stuff like that happen. And I think that I suspect that a lot of people are interfacing with, you know, call it what you will, the paranormal, the supernatural, whatever. I think that people interface with that a lot more often than they realize. It's just so subtle that they don't, you know, think about it. So like, you think you saw a shadow and you turn around and you're like, what was that? And nothing happens. And you're like, okay, I guess it was just, you know, my eyes playing tricks on me. Yeah, that happens. But who says it wasn't actually something that you just ended up writing off, you know?
Oh, yes.
And
that happens a lot.
Yeah. And so, you know, I think that when you're involved in these topics, it gives you a little bit more time to pause and process. And you probably, you know, if you want to stay sane, you probably still throw it into that, you know, coincidence basket, and you still throw it into that, you know, maybe sort of basket, but it does sort of make you stop and appreciate some of the peculiarities that we come up against every day a little bit more.
Yes, indeed. Just to kind of shift gears a little bit. You have written the book literally on paranormal smells, odors. Can you tell us about that?
Yeah, so it's called The Brimstone Deceit, which I think is an accurate title to some degree, but it also kind of sounds like a Joel Osteen book, you know? and I think some people are put off by that because they think that, you know, I'm just going to be talking about how demons smell of sulfur all the time. But, you know, while that's definitely like the glue that holds the book together, I talk about all sorts of paranormal smells in it. But, you know, having said that, that smell of sulfur or brimstone is definitely, if not a majority of smells, definitely a plurality of smells. Once you start looking at that, you sort of tumble down this rabbit hole of the science of smell, which is its own thing, and then the philosophy of smell, which is something that I had no idea existed. But then you also start, like, you know, what I found, one of the things I found most interesting is that, you know, so people report sulfurous smells in abductions and around UFOs and, of course, demons, because that's what everybody goes to when they hear that. But, you know, it's a very common Bigfoot odor. What I discovered, which I don't think people really realize, is that the reason that, like, you know, Satan and demons supposedly smell of sulfur in the Bible is not because they're naturally stinky. I mean, if you look at the passages, if you look at the passages in the Bible, like, sulfur is very clearly a cleansing mechanism that God employs. It talks about his breath coming out like sulfur, and sulfur, you know, to this day is antifungal, antimicrobial qualities. A lot of acne medications have sulfites in them. So the reason that the devil smells that way and his legions smell that way is because God is trying to cleanse them by throwing them into the lake of burning fire. So it's not
okay, inherently... Let me just pause and say, wow, that's an insight I have never heard once. Go ahead.
Yeah. A lot of people, you know, don't really put that together. And I was amazed to find it out too. And then you sort of start looking at sulfur as, you know, the way that people would talk about sulfur and how it's become conflated with ozone over time. Because, for example, your natural gas stove doesn't actually smell. They add sulfur compounds called thiols to it, which are also found in, like, you know, skunk as well. And thiols get their name from thion, from thios, from theos, which is because the Greeks thought that when lightning struck the ground, that was the smell of sulfur. Huh. Well, it's not. It's the smell of ozone. Mm-hmm. But you find this conflation all the way through, like, you know, even the 19th century, where they go in the other direction. They say, oh, you need to go to the seaside because the fresh ozone will help your condition, you know, if you're consumptive or something. But what they were talking about in that case was some of the sulfur compounds is what they were citing. So it all gets flipped around. And then you also have UFOs that smell like ozone. That's a very common smell that people talk about as well. So, you know, it really is this very complex thing where you're trying to parse out what people mean versus what they say. There's, you know, in smell philosophy, there's even a term for this. They call it the tip of the nose phenomena, where you recognize the smell. And smell is miraculous because it's encoded to memory in a way that few other senses are. You know, you get the memories, whether you want to or not, when you smell a very specific odor. But, like, a lot of times the smells are dependent upon context clues and all this stuff. And then you look at sulfur as a compound itself specifically in the way that it combines. And, you know, a lot of people say, you know, well, it smelled like sulfur. It smelled like brimstone. Well, sulfur doesn't smell. It only smells when it combusts. And I think pure sulfur, if memory serves, can combust in, like, you know, direct sunlight. So it's pretty sensitive compound. But as soon as it does that, it's a sensitive element. As soon as it combusts or combines with other things, then it's a different compound. So you have sort of different compounds that you have to talk about, like sulfur dioxide, which is that firework smell or that burning match smell, another common UFO smell, or the one that we always think about a lot, which is hydrogen sulfide. You know, farts don't smell because of methane. Methane, again, is odorless. What you're smelling is mostly these hydrogen sulfide particles, which are a very small component in farts.
That's what we've come to talk about this evening.
Farts, yeah. But no, this is interesting because you don't need that much. I think that we can detect hydrogen sulfide at a concentration of 0.5 parts per billion, which means that if you had an ink dropper and dropped it into the back of a tanker truck filled with water, that ink would be at twice the concentration that we can detect hydrogen sulfide in the environment. We are extremely, extremely finely attuned to recognize hydrogen sulfide because in significant amounts, it is a poison, and it often signifies decay in the absence of oxygen. So it is sort of a defense mechanism. But then you say, okay, well, it's a defense mechanism and we're super fine tuned to smell it. If these phenomena have control over that, what are they trying to tell us? You know, are they trying to get our attention? So,
This reminds me of two things. Mm-hmm. Some people have speculated that the beings that appear in a lot of paranormal phenomena are decaying.
Mm-hmm.
And that what we're smelling is the stench of decay.
I love that idea. I didn't pursue it as much as I should have in the book, but I've since come around to really love that idea. The direction that I ended up taking it in, and I think that one's as valid or more valid than this, but the direction that I ended up taking it in was that, fascinatingly enough, when I looked at sort of the all the smells that people reported, it was like more or less half, I would say, if I had to really put a percentage on it. More or less 50% of all paranormal smells tend to be hydrogen sulfide. And the remainder you can divide into a bunch of different smells. Smells of ammonia, smells of sulfur dioxide, which is that, you know, that gunpowder smell. Smells of ozone, et cetera, et cetera. And I said to myself, so what does this mean that half are this and half are that? You know, obviously we have half. What is this other half that's this sort of mixed bag of smells? And I discovered that a lot of the most common smells on that other half, the non-hydrogen sulfide half of smells that are recorded, are what are known as trigeminal stimulants. And it's something that we all know about, but we don't necessarily have a name for. But it's the trigeminal nerve is actually the largest nerve in your face. And if you've ever smelled ammonia or smelling salts, it's that smell. It actually, like, you know, shocks you. It ignites that nerve in your face. And so a lot of these smells... So basically what I ended up saying then was like, well, so you've got hydrogen sulfide on one side and these trigeminal stimulants that sort of rouse you or they alert you on the other side. Well, as it turns out, there's some recent research that I found from a TED talk that talked about how hydrogen sulfide in very specific, minutely monitored amounts could actually induce suspended animation in lab mice. And of course, you know, the person that was talking about this was very excited about the possible applications for space travel or something. But I said to myself, okay, so you have hydrogen sulfide can put you under and trigeminal stimulants, the other half of the smells, wake you up. So I wonder.
Wow, okay. Yeah.
Yeah. So you see where I'm going with this. So I sort of wondered if perhaps that when people remember the hydrogen sulfide smell, they're not remembering the smell from the beginning of the encounter, right? And then whatever this force is, the supernatural force, is using hydrogen sulfide somehow, I can't posit a mechanism, but it's somehow using hydrogen sulfide to slip people into an altered state of consciousness. And then if they remembered the other smells instead, those trigeminal stimulants, they're remembering the smell that brought them out of that altered state of consciousness. Because I do think that altered states of consciousness play some sort of important role in a lot of these phenomena.
Absolutely. I happen to know that ammonia brings you into the moment. In weightlifting competitions, some guys hit ammonia right before they go lift because it puts you in the here and now. It focuses you. Immediately, you're in the moment. It wakes you up.
And yeah, I'd imagine it's that trigeminal stimulant component is what they're chasing after. Is I would imagine.
Absolutely, yeah. I think that's exactly it. Wow. The other thing was, I'm thinking of the skunk ape, and the stench associated with the abominable snowman, and like. It seemed really weird that a primate animal would stink so bad, you know?
Right. And you hear these stories about, like, you know, it's almost as if the smell switches on or off in some encounters as well. And, you know, I have experienced some frustration with this book because people are often like, you know, I'll bet Bigfoot have scent glands. So I don't know. Maybe somebody should look into that. I'm like, guys, I did the work here. Like, it's right here for you. You know, there is some indication that I believe gorillas are able to release a sort of rubbery, like an odor like burnt rubber when they're alarmed. But to my knowledge, it is not a voluntary control that they exert. At the same time, it's interesting when you sort of look at a lot of these foul odors that people describe, like you said, the skunk ape. Well, again, one of the primary components in The smell of skunk that we find revulsive is a sulfur compound. We're talking about the burning rubber smell that some gorillas might release when they're agitated. Well, burning rubber is often vulcanized. And how do you vulcanize it? You vulcanize it with sulfur compounds. So a lot of these things seem to keep on tracing back to that odor of brimstone, that odor of sulfur, time and time again.
That is a really interesting and little, other than by yourself, investigated subfield of the whole paranormal world, and especially of the Bigfoot world.
In a lot of ways, I think it's the book that I'm proudest of, because I was not a chemistry whiz, so I had to go back and learn a lot of chemistry. But like, you know, you think about like people being like, we need to solve the paranormal with science. I'm like, okay, well, this is my science-y book, you know? That's one of my favorite things to do is to take something that people have remarked upon in passing, or they've maybe dedicated a paragraph to here and there throughout the paranormal literature. And if you see that same paragraph showing up over and over and over again, like the brimstone thing, then you're like, okay, well, I think that there's something to this, and this deserves to be expanded out into a longer form discussion of this aspect of the phenomena that not as many people are paying attention to.
Yes, that makes a lot of sense. Speaking of books that you've written, you and Timothy Renner really took Bigfoot research to another level with the 2-volume Where the Footprints End books. What would you say is the weirdest piece of high strangeness you came across researching that? What really surprised you?
I mean, I will give,
I mean, they're huge. Him... a bunch of answers there, but go ahead.
Well, I mean, so the thing that I found most surprising, and I try to make it a point to give Tim props for this every chance that I get, is his connection of women in white to Bigfoot.
That's the thing. Go ahead.
Well, he came to me and he said that, you know, like, have you ever noticed that women in white are associated with Bigfoot? I'm like, okay, what do you mean by that? I've never seen that. I don't think there's any legs to this. Like, because he cited an example. I'm like, okay, well, you know, if you can find new examples, come back to me. And I'll be damned. Like, it's one of those things that once you see it, you don't stop seeing it, you know? And I think it's, you know, that juxtaposition of the wild man archetype with the highly feminized virginal archetype, for lack of a better term. But you see it in, like, you know, you see it in King Kong, and you see it in Beauty and the Beast. And like, I even had somebody who told me that they thought that maybe the Christmas tree was a representation of the Bigfoot phenomena, because you've got the angel as the woman in white on the top, and you've got Santa Claus, who is, you know, folklorists will agree that Santa Claus is a variation on the wild man archetype, transmitted through the Woodwows and Odin and other characters. And you've got the
medieval Santa Claus is something else.
Yeah. Go ahead. But, and then you've got the Christmas balls and the twinkling lights, like the orbs of light that are seen around Bigfoot as well, and in areas of high Bigfoot activity. So like, once you start to see it, you can't unsee it. And Tim, I mean, it's the gift that keeps on giving. You talk about something that could probably be expanded out into a longer form book. I mean, that's one of them. That's definitely one of them, you know, that this woman in white thread that he started pulling on just keeps on, you know, is the gift that keeps on giving. One of the things that I always find the weirdest of these stories, and it makes sense to a certain degree, in my head, but it's still weird, are these like disembodied Bigfoot appendages, you know, like people who
hand or the arm that just
hand, or like the pair of Bigfoot legs that are running down the road, you know?
Oh yeah. That's really weird. Yeah.
I love those stories. I read one today, for something else that I'm working on about, I mean, you know, it's one of those things that isn't Bigfoot and isn't Dogman, but people from both camps will try to cram it in there. There was a New Jersey, I think this was 1993. There was a New Jersey park ranger who was in Wharton State Forest, who happened upon a big, tall, hairy thing in the summer. He actually made an official report of it, that stepped out into the road in as he was driving his truck, and it just stopped in the road, and he had to stop his car as well. And it looked at him with these glowing red eyes. It was about, I think, 6 feet tall and hairy, and he said that it had a a head resembling a deer, and it didn't seem to have any arms.
Damn.
And, you know, maybe 3 years ago, that would have 3 or 4 years ago, that would have thrown me for a loop. But now I'm like, oh, yeah, that makes sense. You know, that makes sense. Wow. Of course, it's no arms. So that's one of those things. You know, the other thing that I tell you what, I was probably most surprised to see. Was, you know, everybody's aware of the 5-toed Bigfoot tracks. There are 4-toed Bigfoot tracks. Okay, whatever, that could be a wound or something. There are the 3-toed Bigfoot tracks, which are odd, but they're popularized enough that most people are aware of them. I wasn't entirely aware that there were Bigfoot tracks that look like hooves. But sure enough, wow. I believe this was like in the 1930s. I might have the date wrong, but it was called the Traverse Spine Gorilla, and it was in Labrador. Up in Canada, and it was this basically tall ape-like creature that would look in windows, but what it would leave behind would be these footprints that looked like ox footprints as opposed to Bigfoot footprints. Wow. And you know the interesting thing about that is we were talking about how, you know, you can trace the Santa's origins through Odin and the Wild Man and the Wadwos, but the Wild Man itself you can clearly trace back through ideas of satyrs and fauns, which were hairy humans from the waist up and basically goats from the waist down.
Yes.
So it's almost like, you know, it's almost like a hearkening back to that earlier version of the archetype in that story, like from the Traverse Spine Gorilla.
Yeah, I'm thinking of that. I mean, that's what Pan's supposed to look like. And that also, the hoof prints remind me of the Jersey Devil. And wow, that's quite something.
Yeah, and then it's like a spider web. You know, Tim's talked about this before, but like the Wild Man archetype itself alone, because in case anybody's wondering who's listening, like, I don't think Bigfoot's a flesh and blood creature anymore. I think it's somehow playing on this Wild Man archetype, but the Wild Man archetype alone is fascinating because, you know, the satyrs and the fauns were associated with, you know, pre-Christian pagan worship, and of course that got demonized. So the satyrs and the fauns, that sort of appearance, got appended to the devil and to Satan. And a lot of people still call Bigfoot, you know, devils, you know, mountain devils is a very common term for Bigfoot. But also you can branch off, instead of branching off into the Christian demonization of satyrs and fauns into the devil, you can sort of take the other direction, which is, you know, Bigfoot as a Dionysus figure, as a Dionysian figure, which in turn has his own connections as a, you know, the god of debauchery, has his own connections to the Green Man, which is also tied into the Wadwos as well. But, you know, it's quite explicitly in a lot of cases a shamanic figure, shamanic and perhaps even, you know, thonic figure, a figure of the underworld, Dionysus, in some traditions. So it's this gigantic spider web. And of course, you know, the satyrs and the fauns are arguably, you know, a species of fairy as well. And, you know, plenty of comparisons to be made between Bigfoot and fairies. It keeps on branching off in these, it's like tributaries of a river that branch off in these other directions. And before you know it, you know, you need to circle back around to talk about something you were talking about earlier. It makes it all quite difficult to talk about.
Yes. And people always often think that fairies are always tiny, and that's not really the case, is it?
I mean, no. You know, as a general rule, you could say that the things that really unite fairies are a love of kidnapping people, a tendency to live underground, and a tendency to be short. But even those are pretty pretty fungible categories. You know, a lot of the Western European fairies might be short, but a lot of them might very well appear human-sized. What it really seems to come down to, above all else, is that they were, you know, inveterate size and shapeshifters. You know, you'll find stories about, here's another one, there's a story from County Tipperary about a fairy queen who transformed into all manner of things. She transformed into a dragon and a beautiful fairy queen because she was trying to get someone off of her land. And in this description that I found, it also said that she turned into an ape with chicken's feet. And I said, okay, ape with chicken's feet. Bigfoot that leaves behind three-toed tracks. Interesting.
The number of times that bird feet on something that's definitely not a bird come up in your research, it was pretty amazing to me.
Yeah, and it always looks like that. I mean, so in case anybody hasn't seen a three-foot, that'll be fun, a three-toed Bigfoot track, a three-toed Bigfoot track, you know, all you got to do is take a look at it, and you can say, okay, well, I don't know what that is, but these answers that the cryptozoologist will give you, that it's a deformation, or that it's from inbreeding, or they just don't know. It doesn't look like that. Like, it looks nothing like a primate foot. It does look a lot more like a bird foot, in my estimation. And, you know, to the extent that in the South, a lot of people will say that these three-toed Bigfoot tracks are, you know, alligator tracks, which is fine. But when you get into Pennsylvania or Oregon, that's almost as weird as Bigfoot, right? Having an alligator up there.
That's a thing that I find in a lot of the debunkers and the people who aren't explaining or explaining away is, sometimes your mundane explanation is harder to believe than the paranormal thing you're trying to say doesn't exist. Alligators in Pennsylvania, yeah. You know,
yeah, the never-ending circus train crash, right?
Yes. Which is never recorded anywhere.
Well, you know, I've talked about this before, and, like, you know, Occam's razor gets weaponized a lot by skeptics, but what they don't really realize is that they're citing a monk who is using it to argue, you know, theological arguments. So it's kind of a misplaced weapon in that sense anyway. But also, I mean, you know, Occam's razor actually doesn't mean that the simplest answer is true. It means that you shouldn't multiply variables unnecessarily. And, you know, I think the idea that there is an alligator that's living in Pennsylvania, like I said, is almost as hard to believe as the fact that there's just something out there that we don't know, full stop.
Yes, indeed.
So, yeah, I'm trying to remember what I was talking about. Oh, yeah, these three-toed tracks, you're right. And I think that there's something sinister to it.
It's weird. I mean, they're not, why would they have bird feet? Except a lot of folkloric beings have bird feet.
And I think that you could make a cogent case that a lot of these Bigfoot, that leave behind the three-toed tracks tend to be more aggressive. You've got, like, you know, the Falk monster and the Missouri monster, Momo, spring immediately to mind. You know, and Momo was famous for having, you know, killing dogs. And, you know, I think the first appearance had a dog under its arm. So, there's something to that, and I think just like the three-toed track, which again sort of looks like that the Druden foot is the witch's foot, but the rune is called the Elhaz rune, I think. It just, something about it just feels real occulty to me, and not occulty in the way that we in, you know, the paranormal field like to say, oh, it just means hidden. I mean, occulty in that sort of negative occulty sort of way.
Yes. Let me put a couple of caveats on here. I don't mean the Judeo-Christian Orthodox theology, but it does seem kind of demonic, to be blunt.
Yeah. And, you know, that theme of three is something that shows up more often than people, I think, perceive as well. You know, Nessie almost always has these three humps that float through the water, and, you know, Men in Black, you know, the flying saucers and the three men, like the first modern appearance of Men in Black was, you know, three men. And, you know, how many times have you read a UFO report and it's like a trio of beings walked out of the craft? It's like, you know, and people will tell you that demons show up at 3 a.m. and they leave three scratches, and, you know.
What I never get is people always say there's three knocks to mock the Trinity. And I'm like, really? That's your idea of mockery? Bang, bang, bang. Really? That's it? That's the worst the devil has to say? Come on.
well, the 3 a.m. thing kind of makes sense, because I think historically, like, or, you know, canonically Christ died at 3 p.m. So it's like an inversion of that. I get that, but like three knocks doesn't really seem to be, it is kind of weak sauce, you know?
Yeah, I've never seen that really that's the best the devil would bring. Come on.
Yeah, I don't, I don't buy it. But then you've got all those three-toed tracks all over Hellier, you know? Some of the shenanigans that were going on there. And I think there was some mention of some of the nasty, so somebody's going to listen to this and say that I got it wrong, but I think some Klansmen in Kentucky who were ex-Confederate soldiers would bury their treasure, and supposedly they used that same three-pronged rune to mark a lot of their treasure areas. Wow. According to folk legend or whatever.
Yes, yes. Uh-huh.
And so that's something else that when I heard that, I heard that on Pennyroyal this latest season. And when I heard that, I said, yeah, there's just something dark about that. And I haven't really dug enough into that specific rune to know if there's some sort of connotation there that's negative or not. But yeah.
If I can just digress for a second, people forget how occultic the Klan was.
They were
the reason they were dressed up in these outfits was to terrify people that they were ghosts. They pretended to be the ghosts of Confederate dead, and they would do things to fake paranormal phenomena, like drink incredible amounts of water with a rubber bladder to soak up the water, and do things to scare people. They wanted people to think they were ghosts and the ghosts of the Confederate dead. And there was a whole occultic side to the Klan that was way beyond just being a hate group. And it's all very bad, but it's bad in a specific way, you know?
Well, you know, that's something that, again, like I'm invested in the paranormal, so I'm not trying to say that it's all bad, but I think we sort of fall into this trap when we're interested in these topics where we don't, we're so inundated with how negative this stuff is in popular culture that we sort of start to ignore the negativity that does come with it. But man, some of the stuff is dark and it will eat your lunch. And the fact that you've got that going on, and you've got, you know, the Nazi obsession with, you know, the occult. And I heard some interesting stuff about Putin being interested in a bunch of that stuff as well. And maybe it's just, you know, what you do when you become, you know, a bloodthirsty dictator or something, like you just got all this time on your hands. But it kind of makes me wonder if there isn't something that's drawing people to this. And I think it's something to guard against in your own practice as you look into these different topics. Like, you know, that's why I'm glad I got the music to retreat to, because I've seen it, man. I've seen people who just live this stuff and breathe this stuff. And it will, like I said, it'll eat your lunch. It really will.
This might sound dumb, but I'm not afraid to sound dumb. So anyway, one of the things that when I really need to get away from this, because yeah, you know, you can't do this 24/7 and keep your head together. And they tell you that if you go into a formal, like studying, say, Kabbalah, you're supposed to be of a certain age, a certain stability in your life, because it can be erratic, you know.
Mm-hmm.
I will, like, I'm a big Green Bay Packers fan, and sometimes I just need to leave this all aside and go talk about the Green Bay Packers, because that is down to earth and regular mundane world, and that is kind of a pause, you know.
And get a hobby, folks, you know.
And it's necessary, because if you eat and sleep this, it may have bad effects. And I mean, you can see countless examples. I'm thinking of Jack Parsons, but there's plenty of other people like that, you know, that it ends up consuming you. And you don't want to get consumed. You know, that's not good.
Yeah, no, yeah. And, you know, I think you can see that, too, with sort of the proliferation of you know, some of the QAnon stuff and the way that it's drawn people in.
Oh, yeah.
And all the sort of, frankly, occult phenomena, you know, occult trappings that are sort of around that. Like, I've seen people who, you know, one minute they get involved in some of that stuff, and then the next they're sending me links to like Michael Sala's secret, you know, space warrior program and all this other BS, you know, the real disreputable part of the UFO community who just make things up. And I'm like, how did you get from there to here? And it's because it's traveling in that same orbit, you know.
Oh yes. And that's, you know, this is multi-dimensional. I don't mean it that way, but I mean, there's people who are really interested in this stuff, and there's always grifters trying to find them and separate them from their money. And there's people using this for political gain. And, you know, I'm 51. When like a lot of conspiracy stuff started in the 90s, we were afraid of the feds. You know, we're afraid the feds were going to come and kill us. Now it seems like a lot of people into that subgenre conspiracy theory want to be feds. They want to be deputized and go and get the bad guys. And that's a real change.
Well, it's the same thing that you saw in, you know, the UFO community around the time that to the Stars Academy of Arts and Sciences, which I still maintain sounds like a Montessori school. when the TTSA stuff started coming out, you know, how they were all, you know, cozying up to all these, you know, people who used to be part of these old three-letter agencies. And, you know, I heard... You know, I heard it said at one point, I think it was Chris O'Brien who said this, you know, once a spook, always spooky. And, you know, people don't retire lightly from those agencies. You know, you're kind of a lifer, I think, in a lot of cases. And here you have all these people from all those things partnering and suddenly being interested in, oh, they're the ones who are going to tell you about you, the truth behind UFOs. Okay. Yeah. So it's sort of the same impulse, I think, in some ways, just wanting to join the, like you said, join the feds, I guess.
Yes. Yeah. And I'll just make this admission. Part of me knows that disclosure is probably BS. It's probably never going to happen. And, you know, why should we take people who spent 30 years doing disinformation? Now we're going to listen to the real truth, really? You know, I know how dumb that sounds, but a little part of me really wants them to bring out the crashed alien ship and announce it on the evening news. That, you know, that's just the thing that, you know, I'll probably never stop wanting, which will also probably never happen. And if it does, it's probably fake. But anyway, yes. You know.
Well, I mean, that's the thing, is that we're in this sort of post-truth world. Like, I mean, you know, anybody in our authority structure could step out with an alien body tomorrow and be like, this is the real deal. They're here. And like half the country wouldn't believe it. You know, I mean, I'd be in that half too, because I'm, you know, always skeptical of what the government says about UFOs, but like for purely political reasons, people wouldn't believe it. So I think the idea that, you know, disclosure in that sense will ever be obtainable, I think is a bit optimistic, you know. And I think that's kind of not keeping in line with my view of the phenomena, which I think is not extraterrestrial. I think that is part of the point behind the phenomena. Disclosure isn't given to you. Disclosure is something that you arrive at yourself, you know. You sort of reach this critical mass, you know, like I alluded to earlier, like you have something happen to you where you Goldilocks your way there with data, and you can't put the toothpaste back in the tube. You're like, okay, well, there's something to this. There's something going on, you know, and as long as you can sort of maintain, in my opinion, the sort of level of healthy agnosticism about it, then there you go. That's your disclosure right there. You know that something's going on, and just resign yourself to the fact that in your lifetime, that's probably as good as it's going to be, you know?
I think you really hit the nail on the head there. Yes. So much of this also seems to me, and not only to me, but to many, to be performative. Like, what you're seeing is a presentation that's made for you. And I've never seen a UFO. I saw a cryptid once. But what people see is geared to what they need to see.
Mm-hmm. I think your cryptid sighting really underscored that, right? Because your wife saw something completely different. She saw a Bigfoot and you saw a bear thing.
Yes, that's correct. Yeah. Yes. Now, it was a weird bear that can't exist in nature, but it was still two different things. Yes.
Right.
And we were there at the same moment, and thank God, because that way I wasn't having a psychotic break. But we both saw something. We saw something vaguely similar, but still very different. And it seems like we were meant to see what we saw, you know, and that was presented to us. And that, I don't know why that works that way, but I do believe it does work that way. That what you see is created for you to see.
Yeah. Go
ahead. Somebody could be standing next to you and not see the same thing.
Well, and that happens more than people realize, you know, that some people, you know, there's a story that I recorded where two people agree that they saw a UFO, but one saw a Thunderbird and the other one saw a giant amoeba flying through the sky, you know?
Wow. Okay.
But there are also stories of people who disagree on how many lights there were or the color of the lights. There are stories even back into the ghost tradition where, you know, there was a story that I found in one of the caretakers of the Tower of London was eating dinner with his wife, and he and like I think someone else saw it, but his wife and another person who was there at the dinner party didn't see this like cylindrical arm that was flying through the through the dining room.
Wow.
And yeah, and it's like so obviously, you know, I think these things are tailor-made, you know, for a very specific audience at the time. And you know, people will be like, well, I didn't, you know, nothing profound happened to me because of that. Why would it care? But I think maybe you might not realize what the purpose was, you know, or maybe the purpose behind it was to keep you from doing something or to do something that might seem completely unrelated, but it nonetheless pushed you in that direction. Like, I think that's, if you had to ask me exactly what I think it is, I think it might have something to do with that. You know, it's this extremely highly personalized experience that sometimes you get to, you know, share with other people. But I believe that it's a theatrical presentation meant for the person who experiences it. I really do.
Yeah, that makes a lot of sense. Not to shift gears too hard, but going back to your Bigfoot research, could you tell us a little bit about this? I don't think I've ever heard it except from you and Timothy Renner, but there's an equivalent to the Men in Black for Bigfoot. Two guys that go around and they're like the same two guys and they like try to silence witnesses or something.
Yeah. This is something that emerged more recently on, you know, the Sasquatch Chronicles podcast. I think he popularized it, where there are these individuals and, you know, depending on your perspective, you think that it's government agents or something stranger. I, of course, tend to fall into the idea that it's something stranger, but it's a real odd couple. One is dressed like a, you know, stereotypical G-man in his suit, and he's a slighter build, and he's, you know, very clean cut. And the other one is, by all accounts, a very tall kind of biker dude, oftentimes wearing a checkered flannel shirt with a white t-shirt underneath, big beard. And Typically, it's both or just the biker dude. And they will show up and they will harass witnesses and tell them that they saw what they didn't think they saw. You know, you saw a bear, you saw the rear end of a deer, you saw this or that or the other. You know, there's a story from Glacier National Park where a young ranger, a young guy working in the forestry service, stumbled upon a Bigfoot with his friend, and this guy rocks it the next day. Now, his friend's uncle that he saw it with claimed that he knew the man and that he was from Dillon, Montana, and all this stuff. But he made a big show of you know, questioning the witness's credibility in front of him. And okay, so that might be, you know, I think it was he showed up in a big black SUV with government plates, and that might be a government agent, sure, why not? But there are other stories that are a lot more peculiar where they show up before the witness has mentioned it to anyone. You know, there's a story that Tim collected where this guy, this big biker guy, and the more slender gentleman were harassing a police officer who, on his beat, kept on running into these reports of gorillas. And he was sort of, you know, passively looking into it, had a little bit of interest in it. And the two individuals harassed him and told him to stop. He confronted the bigger individual, and he got suspended. And when he was reinstated, he was called out on a prowler call. And he was alongside the house, and long story short, he didn't find a prowler. He found a Bigfoot that was, you know, threw a log rather at his head and barely missed him. And he pulls his firearm on it and aims at the Bigfoot, and he's distracted by a sound from behind him. And he glances, and when he glances back, the Bigfoot isn't there, but the biker dude is. Wow. And the biker dude comes up and puts his hand on his shoulder and says, "Couldn't pull the trigger, could you? Good man." And, you know, if you want to tell me that's a government agent, I mean, I guess he could have been, you know, shadowing him or something. But I can't.
That's some pretty deep cover, you know?
Yeah, exactly. And, you know, what was pointed out by our mutual friend, Barbara Fisher's daughter, Morgana, was that they kind of sound like bear and coyote, or bear and wolf. Huh. Bear and wolf showing up to defend the forest, right? And in one of these accounts where in Glacier National Park, the guy actually told his the guy who said that his name was Gary, he said, "No, you call me bear So that's the sort of level that I like to operate on, is this idea that maybe, like, there's just this built, whatever the phenomena is, there's this built-in defense mechanism. And, you know, I'm not so sure that, you know, you see that with the Men in Black, right? Like, anybody who wants to tell you that even most of the strange Men in Black are government agents, I don't even know what to tell you, because they just don't act like it. They're almost always like these corpses wearing makeup, you know.
Yes, they
seem to be much more part and parcel of the UFO phenomena itself. And I think something similar is going on with the Bigfoot phenomena, but appropriately enough, it sort of bends itself to a figure of authority that might resonate more with an outdoorsy type, which is, you know, a big, you know, biker dude who beat you, you know. Like,
don't they claim to be from the Bureau of Land Management or something?
Yeah, I've heard the Bureau of Land Management. I've heard Homeland Security. You know, they say different places and say different things. But like I said, and this sort of line of thinking, for me at least, extends to, like, you know, maybe these people and the Bigfoot are one and the same, you know, because,
yeah,
somehow
connected. Yeah.
Well, I mean, you know, a lot of the indigenous traditions, and I'm not deliberately speaking monolithically about them, but, like, there are so many that don't have them on the tip of my tongue, and B, like, it would take a while to enumerate, but a lot of indigenous traditions specifically talk about Bigfoot and their Bigfoot, you know, analogs as being shapeshifters. Mm-hmm. And you find hints of this here and there, like, you know, they talk about, you know, Bigfoot prints, not only, you know, the trackways not only abruptly ending, but sometimes the trackways shape-shifting into another form, like a shoe, or, you know, tracks from shoes, or you know, there's a story that I collected. There's a story that I can't remember the guy's name, but he collects Bigfoot stories, and it was these four-wheeler riders, and I believe it was Pennsylvania, and they spotted a Bigfoot that crossed in front of them, and they said, hey, it's coming into these trees, where it should come out will be on the other side. So they circled around to where they thought they would catch it coming out the other side of this grove of trees, and there wasn't a Bigfoot, but there was like a 1950s greaser who was like Fonzie, right?
Yeah, yes,
like and he was smoking a cigarette that like didn't smell, but still like left some smoke, and he was wearing these like pristine white boat shoes, even though it was muddy, and they were talking to him, and he said, I haven't seen anything strange. And then for some reason they were both distracted and they looked away. And when they looked back, he was gone.
Yeah. Yes, indeed.
Might not have been, you know, I can't say that definitely is tied to the Bigfoot thing, but like, it's like when people want to dismiss UFOs seen in the vicinity of Bigfoot, like, okay, well, it's rare to see Bigfoot. It's even rarer to see a UFO. As Tim says, like, how much rarer is it to see them both together, you know, or they're connected. So in that case, I think that, yeah, it's, I guess whatever phenomena is behind Bigfoot, he's just like, a greaser, yeah, just a Fonzie. There we go. We'll
do that. And that, again, that's a perfect example of one of those things that you can't prove ever that wasn't just some guy in jeans and leather jacket, but it makes no sense for that to happen. You know, that it defies logic.
Right, know? Right.
You've pointed out something that I've noticed with the Men in Black and with, well, especially the Men in Black, they purport to be silencers. They're going to shut these people down, but yet they don't seem to really silence people all that effectively. You know, unless there's a bunch of people that are silenced that we don't know about, it seems like people talk about this stuff anyway and nothing ever comes of it. You know what I mean?
Yeah, that's a good point. And I don't know if
we say that
because we never hear from the people that were truly intimidated, right?
And maybe they were silenced, you know. Maybe that does happen. But it just seems like it's
heavy-handed.
Yes.
Right? I mean, it's very heavy-handed. And I don't know, I mean, that's sort of when you almost get into ideas you know, ideas in the magical tradition of these things feeding off of fear or something along those lines, which I think is, you know, possible. Yeah.
That's a different way of looking at it. I had not thought of what I was thinking of is it's almost like performative again, that they want you to think you're on the right track. This is a big deal. You better not talk to anybody because, you know, you're going to be in big trouble. The big trouble never comes, but it spreads the story. And it makes people think that, oh, that must be what happened.
Well, it's that old, I think it's the Herbert Shermer abduction from Nebraska where, you know, he was taken and they said, he said, what do you want? They said, we want you to believe in us, but not too much. You know?
Yeah, that is a perfect phrase. Yes, that has always stuck in my mind. oh man, let me see. We have gone around a little bit. Just do you mind a few random off the wall questions?
I love random. Are you kidding me? I love random off the wall questions.
Okay. I will feel free to hit you with stuff that, you know, doesn't necessarily relate to anything we've talked about previously. What's your take on Atlantis? And I don't expect you to like have prepared answer. I'm just talking here.
No, I mean,
just two guys talking, you know.
I think it's highly possible, maybe even probable, that there was a civilization that was out to sea. And you know, we have this idea that anything, you know, including evolution, but also human progress, is this, you know, straight line, straight vertical, you know, straight incline.
Oh yes.
And I don't think that's the case at all. I think that civilizations have risen and peaked. Like using using media that we haven't even thought to use, you know. You look at some of those Egyptian sculptures that are made of diorite that are just like, you know, could barely, if at all, be machined today. And it's like, well, obviously they had some sort of technology that we haven't even thought about implementing. I think that it's entirely possible that there was a civilization like that. I mean, it's kind of like the flood myth. Like you hear too many analogs for it to be nonsense. Now, do I think that, you know, they spread across the world and that they built the Native American mounds and that they, you know, we've all been reincarnated because they were star seeds from, you know, Zeta Reticuli or something? No. But I do think it's entirely possible that there's something like that. And I think it's also possible that, like, we've already found it. We just don't recognize it, you know, in that sort of Graham Hancock territory, you know, things like the Bimini Road and some of these other anomalies in the C4.
Yeah.
You know, I think that's entirely possible.
You mentioned earlier something with the Fae and living underground. What do you think of theories and stories of a hollow earth or a huge cavern that contains, you know, civilization?
I mean, there's something to it, and you find this time and time again, but the way that I tend to look at that nowadays, and I should hope that if you asked me in another, you know, 2 years, I would think differently. But the way that I often think about it is more as a metaphorical motif, talking about how these things dwell in our subconscious and come out, you know, from the subconscious. Similar thing with, you know, lake monsters, in the way that they, you know, peak up above the water and then they essentially go underground, right? They go underneath the waves. So that's kind of what I think, but I'm not writing off the possibility that there's something genuinely strange underneath the earth. You know, it makes a lot of sense. I mean, some of these cave systems are just staggeringly huge, and those are just the ones that we have access to and that we've discovered. And you hear the stories of, you know, Bigfoot popping in and out of these caves and abandoned mines so often. But again, I think that it probably speaks to that on a more metaphorical level than a literal level, because that's just the way that I tend to think about these things, is that they can be physical, but they, you know, we have some sort of co-creative role to play in the way that they manifest. And I think that might be what it's trying to tell us.
Makes a lot of sense. I get the impression that they're physical for a time. They're physical while they're right in front of you, but they're not physical all the time. That they don't have a nest somewhere that you can, like, discover it and, aha, here they are. Here's their den, you know.
We're going to go find a Mothman egg, yeah, like Tim always says, yeah.
Yes, and you're not going to find that. There's not a lot of these things, as being a flesh and blood creature, it's just not, it's not possible without, like, America has vast, and Canada has vast forests and swamps, that something like that could exist, but then nobody ever see it.
Right.
If we're seeing it frequently, and it was just a physical being, the same as a raccoon, let's say, we'd have a dead one, or we'd have a live one. You know, we'd have a body.
Yeah, I mean, that's the thing that you know, the flesh and blood Bigfooters always say, is like, you know, well, we don't find a lot of you know, cougar carcasses and a lot of bear carcasses. And I'm like, yeah, but in the course of human history, people have found these things, you know.
And you can go to the zoo and see the cougar and see the bear, and you know, you can find them stuffed at, you know, a taxidermy place, and we have that. This is something where we don't have that. And again, there's like the orang pendek, that supposedly upright walking orangutan that lives in like the rainforest, and I think it's Borneo. Okay, something like that could exist, but nobody ever sees it because it's in the absolute middle of nowhere. You can't be seeing these things, you know, an hour's drive from Chicago,
right?
And never have a body, you know.
Yeah, and I mean, you know. actually, there are a couple of cases that we found, like cases in Chicago, you know, in some of these parks and stuff. And it's like, it just, it's not a thing. Having said that, you know, all cryptids are not created equal. Like, I think that of the hominids that are out there, I think Orang Pendek is a great candidate for something that could actually be a flesh and blood creature. But I think that, like, you know, the analogy that I like to use is the way that Mike Clellan talks about the owls, right? Mike, of course, believes that there are real owls out there, right? But sometimes they show up in the wake of or precede these UFO sightings, and it seems like they're much stranger and much different. Now, is that, you know, the phenomena using the mask of an owl to appear a certain way, or is it like them warging, to use a Game of Thrones term, into an owl, you know, and taking over its faculties? I don't know, but, you know, we can have multiple things going on at the same time. And it may very well be that in the Pacific Northwest, there is a very, you know, quote unquote mundane flesh and blood, you know, large hairy hominid that's out there. But to say that that's always the case, I just can't get behind that explanation when you see some of the strange stuff that's happening.
Yes. And you've really, you know, dug up a lot of the connections. The way that you and Tim Renner took apart the Ape Canyon story was pretty great. I mean, that story gets told and told and told and told, but with all the weird stuff left out.
Yeah, that might be one of the other things that really blew my mind when I found it. And, you know, again, I'll be damned. There's a woman in white in there. You know, there's a specter of a woman that they called Vander White, whom they named their mine after, who supposedly led them to their mining claim. But, you know, the only thing that you hear about in the cryptozoological literature is, oh, their cabin was attacked by a bunch of Bigfoot. They don't talk about that. They don't talk about there being a large white arrow in the sky that they followed. Yes, they don't talk about, you know, Fred Beck having a porch happen at the cabin. He had a pencil flash into his grip. One thing that I found that I think, I'm going to toot my horn here a little bit, I don't think anybody had put this together, because even in people who acknowledged the stranger aspects of the Ape King story, I'd never seen this before. But there was a newspaper article that I found that was an allusion to an attack on miners in a cabin near Mount St. Helens that same year. So it's got to be Ape Canyon. But there are some allusions to them going up and finding footprints around the cabin, but they were all of one of the feet, I believe, they were all left foot. And it's of course the article was like, this is why it was a hoax. But I'm like, okay, no, that makes perfect sense. So that's another layer of oddity that you can layer onto the Ape Canyon stuff.
And if somebody was going to hoax it, they'd make a left and a right foot, you know. The hoax would be a lot more convincing than that, you know.
Right. Pardon the pun, right.
Exactly. You know, sometimes the explaining away is less logical than, you know, we just don't know what the hell why that would happen.
Yeah.
But it happened, you know. To totally change, well, maybe not totally, but to change topics, with climate change happening, what do you think, if anything, we're going to find with Antarctica?
So, I mean, you know, I want the stories of pyramids in Antarctica and stuff like that to be true. And I think that there's something to that, or that there could be something to it, because, I mean, you talk about places that we just don't have a lot of good intel on, right? That would be one of them. But I think it was Soraya who said that in conversation with Walter Bosley, that he or someone he knew had been told about pyramids in Antarctica, and he was told not to tell anybody about them, and he didn't. And then you have these whistleblowers coming out and saying, they told me that there were pyramids in Antarctica, you know, and he suggested, and I think this sort of thing goes on a lot more than we realize. he said that he thought that maybe it was a test to discern who could be trusted with sensitive information and who couldn't be.
A confidentiality test. We're going to tell you something amazing, and if you can keep it to yourself, then you've earned our trust. If you're on a podcast talking about it, then we're probably not going to tell you much else.
Right, right. And, you know, you find these things here and there. I remember, I don't want to misspeak because I don't think it's my place, and I can't remember the exact name of the documents either, but there was a friend of mine who was actually asked to publish some transcripts pertaining to something along the lines of a secret space program. And when they published them online, they were contacted by their source and said, "Why did you do that?" And they said, "You know, what are you talking about?" And they said, why did you change things?" It was like, "Well, all I did was fix some typos and some punctuation." And they said, "No, you are to print it exactly as it was written." Which to me and to this friend of mine sounds a lot like a cipher, right? It sounds like there's a cipher or something encoded in that message for whatever that the audience truly was.
You bring up a valuable point that, yes, in so I think, all of this stuff, there's always like some cryptic spycraft going on.
Exactly. Yeah, absolutely. And it's such a good place for it to hide. You know, it's like restaurants in the mafia. You know, it's just a good place for this sort of thing to hide. Yeah.
And I mean, I'm thinking of way back to John Dee being the Queen's mystic, but also being like the head of her intelligence service. And how much is magic grimoires and how much is coded language for much more like military purposes?
And again, it's probably a little bit of both. Because I do believe that old adage, I think it was John Jacob Astor who said that, millionaires don't believe in astrology, billionaires do. You know? And I think that there's something like, you know, the people who, you know, have their act together, at least in terms of the way that we think of having their act together by being, you know, rich. That's the way we think of it nowadays.
Yes.
Or powerful. Or powerful, you know. They place a lot of weight in this, and whether or not that's some sort of obsessive compulsive superstition or it's that there's something to it, I don't know. Again, probably somewhere in between, I would imagine. But I think that there's something like that. And there's so much of this stuff. I mean, the same thing with the whole TTSA thing. You know, the Navy's like, "Oh, we're taking civilian UFO reports for the first time in forever." And I'm like, does that not sound like crowdsourcing to you? You know?
Yes. Yes, indeed.
So you've always got to be on the lookout for that sort of thing, I think.
Mm-hmm. And exactly. So there's so many things that go on behind the scenes that it's awfully tough to get it's impossible to get an accurate picture of how the world really works, you know? Every once in a while, you'll have someone come forward and say, "Hey, this totally crazy thing was revealed to me," and you're never going to find whether that was true or not, you know? I guess we should probably, we're kind of reaching the 2-hour mark here. We should probably kind of wrap things up here, Josh. Thanks a ton for coming by. Always fascinating to talk with you. Please, is there anything you'd like to tell our audience about your band, about your books, about anything?
Well, this has been an absolute blast, and I'd like to reiterate that. I think we talked about this beforehand, but there are some people that you can just sit down with and just chat with because, you know, they can hang and they can, and they can talk about this stuff. And there, you know, some people that it's like, you know, It's like pulling teeth, and this was not the latter. So, but it's
been really cool. I will always love talking with you, man.
I have a bunch of irons in the fire right now. You can find out stuff about me, books and whatnot, at joshuacutchin.com, JOSHUACUTCHIN.com. Links to all my interviews are up there, as well as where you can find my books. I, surprisingly enough, do have some events coming up this summer, which is extremely refreshing after all everything with COVID.
God, yeah.
The first of which is that I will be, very proud of this. I will be at Dragon Con in Atlanta. I've been submitting like, hey, can I be a guest? Can I be a guest? And finally they said I can be. Now I have no idea what that's going to entail, but but it is just right down the road.
Not from Georgia. What is Dragon Con? Go ahead.
It is primarily a comic book convention. But they do have a Supernatural track. So Dragon Con this year will be September 1st through 5th in Atlanta. And you know, dragoncon.org, I think it is.
I mean, really, the name alone, you pretty much got me. But go
ahead. and they have some, like, they have like top tier celebrity guests. I think it's like maybe it's like sub San Diego Comic Con for in terms of you know, the sort of guests that they bring in and stuff. Then August 5th through 7th, I will be in Cape Girardeau, Missouri at the Strange Tales Midwest Conference on the Unknown. You can find that at Cape Events, cape-events.com. They're still getting the website up and running, but that'll be happening as well with a real rogues gallery of speakers. And then the following weekend, I told you I was busy. I will be at the Worldwide Metaphysical Tribe meetup, August 11th through 14th in Franklin Grove, Illinois. So just down the road from you, actually. I'll be giving it's a sort of a weekend retreat that they do, and I'll be speaking at that as well. A lot of things coming down the pike this summer. I have two books that are, one is completely finished. Well, three books, I guess. One is completely finished. The other two are making their way there. The first one is an essay on that I edited and contributed to an essay collection of looking at different films through the fairy folklore lens and seeing how they sort of express those motifs in ways that you expect and don't expect. So, like, you know, we've got movies that are talking about fairy stuff, and we also have like Dune in there as well. So, okay. You know, and Rocky Horror and Close Encounters of the Third Kind. Like, it's a real cross section, and then Dark Crystal and Labyrinth. Okay, so you know, it really runs the gamut. I have two books, a two-parter that's coming out hopefully in a couple of months. Called Ecology of Souls, A New Mythology of Death and the Paranormal. And that is, I didn't intend for it to be Josh's theory of everything right now, but like the more I started peeling it away, the more I'm like, oh, this is kind of where my head is at in general. And that is going to talk about, obviously significant portion of it is the UFO experience, but also everything from monuments to ley lines to near-death experiences to ancient pagan deities to, of course, fairies and cryptids as well. So it's really, it's like it became Josh's theory of everything. So that'll be coming down the pipe. I'm really excited about it. So, but I don't want to put any time tables on it, because you know how that goes. As soon as you say that,
the publishing world takes place in Netherland. We don't know. Yeah.
But time does not exist. But we are. I would feel comfortable saying that we are quite close now, and I've incorporated all my edits, and I'm just waiting on the layout to be all set and for some endorsements to come in. So,
cool. Sounds really great. Well, hey, thank you for being a guest. Had a great time talking with you, and hopefully have you back here pretty soon.
Thanks so much, Vincent. This is a blast.
All right. folks, this has been The Weird Part. I am your host, Vincent Treewell. Thanks for listening, and good night.